Good afternoon. Welcome to the Mass Generals podcast with Maddie Lynch and Donnie Palmer. Brought to you by the Braintree Project, and we're here at Hedgebetter Studios. Today's a special day. We have a former state rep and current Republican candidate for governor, Jeff Deal.
Hey guys, how you doing?
Good.
Thanks for having me. Good to see y'all.
So happy St. Patrick's Day, right? We all got our green on.
Got it on.
I think we've done well with this, you know. We got real Irish, black Irish, so it works out both ways on that stuff. So we wanted to bring you in here, Jeff. You know, you're running for the Republican candidate for governor. You've done a lot in your past. Maybe our audience doesn't know everything about you. So, you know, if you want to take a couple minutes and kind of explain, like, hey, where you started, where you got your foot in, how you got to this point in time running for candidate for governor.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. And Donnie, I really appreciate you guys having me on the show, because making sure that folks out there are aware of what's going on, not just with the current issues and things that you guys talk about, but making sure politics, people understand. I think people at this point understand if they don't take a role in it, it's going to take control of their lives. Mm-hmm. You know, the case was made a little while ago that governors may be more powerful than the president. They were the ones that suspended people's civil liberties during the pandemic and decided what businesses were shut down and all that. So that's why this governor's race is so important.
And I was going to say, they just got rid of the emergency, right?
Back in June, they got rid of it, but they've been taking forever to lift all the other parts of the mandate.
And
right?
That gives them that power.
Mayor Wu in Boston, you know, still went forward after the state mandate or state emergency was lifted, still did the vaccine passports, still did tried to force firefighters and police officers and city workers to get the vaccines, you know, over their own healthcare concerns, right? So that's how important it is to elect the right leader. So my background, just so you know, and I live in Whitman, just south here of Braintree. Yep, exactly. My wife grew up in the town of Whitman, so I got lucky. I married into a great town. And my wife and I met in New York City on a blind date. So she had just done a Broadway show. And
it wasn't Tinder though, right? That wasn't around back
then. No, none of that stuff. No, we literally, her roommate and my roommate were doing graduate work together in college, and so they put us together. And so I showed up. We got engaged 5 months after we met. We just knew it was the right thing, and we got married a year after that. And my wife, after her acting career, when she was done with that, we were ready to have kids. She wanted to move back to her hometown near her parents because she wanted them to be a part of helping raise the kids.
Now, was she on Broadway?
She was.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, exactly. It was pretty cool. Yeah. And I was working.
So you were playing second fiddle when you were out there.
I've always been second fiddle. When I ran for state rep the first time, I knocked on doors and said, I'm Kathy Jo's husband. That's how I introduced myself, you know. So, you know, we were married for about 5 years before we had our first kid. And our first daughter's name's Kaylee. My 4 years later, had a second daughter named Emily, and my wife and I, we opened a performing arts school. Her plan B after acting was going to be open a performing arts school on the South Shore, teach kids dance and acting and voice. She loved the studio she had grown up in, so she wanted to do something like that.
It's exactly what she did. Still an active studio, right?
Yeah, years in business so far. We were renting from a space underneath a restaurant for about 12 years and looking for a property. And as the business grew, we found a perfect place to develop. We built a brand new studio and state-of-the-art dance rooms and acting and singing and video and all. So we've got a great studio, yeah. And 20 years old, hundreds of kids have graduated from
the
studio.
Awesome.
Some of those kids now are either teaching at the studio, or they have kids themselves who are students now. So we're at that age where you're like, holy smokes, this thing really worked.
And they always come back too for those kids. That was the same thing with me, where, you know, I got back into, you know, teaching and coaching. I know you played sports and stuff. It was sports that got me back into coaching and teaching, where I didn't necessarily want to be a teacher when I first started, but I wanted to coach because my mentor was a coach. So I came back, and the first game back, I was like, yeah, I'm going to help coach basketball. And I was like, I'll get into teaching.
Whether you're a boy or a girl, you know, when you have a great leader in whatever you're doing, whether I was in the Boy Scouts, right? I love scouting, and I became an Eagle Scout, and I really had a ton of respect for the guys who ran the scout troop that I was in. But, you know, whether it was sports for you or my wife teaching dance, you know, she had her mentors as dancers that she's still friends with to this day. It creates that link for kids beyond the family of kind of local, giving back locally to the place that kind of brought you up the right way and taught you a valuable skill and things like
that.
That's
the community.
That's exactly what it is. I know you've got a beautiful daughter.
Yeah, I need to bring her down. I actually want to bring her down.
Yeah, so you got to have my wife show her a few steps or two, or maybe she can show my wife a few steps.
You got an in now.
We're open all Sundays. We're closed, but Saturdays you can bring her
down.
By.
Yes,
good. Awesome. But so anyway, I was working. I got a job in a sign company in Brockton. I was working in graphic department for a while, and I ended up doing some sales for them. And this is the early 2000s, I think now. And I ended up becoming sort of a sales rep for Reebok. They were the big client for the sign company I was working for in Brockton, right? And Reebok just kept growing and growing, and I was doing a lot of stuff.
The 90s were
big. Really yeah. getting big. And then 2000s, they kept bringing all these stars in, and, you know, their Canton office, we started doing a lot of prototyping of storefronts for them. It was a lot of great, crazy big stuff. Yeah. Anyway, I ended up hitting kind of a ceiling with that company, so I went to a bigger sign company out of New Bedford, the largest sign company in New England. It's called Poyant Signs, and that's where I started doing a lot of really big projects. So Sovereign Bank, for example, started buying up other bank branches and stuff. And we've seen it every now and again, you know, Rockland Trust expands, you know, they take over other branches and things. So what you do as a sign company is you have to not only sell the project that you're going to help do the, you know, the conversion of all that, the signs on the building and the big freestanding signs, but you also have to do the permitting, right? Make sure that you get the zoning and you get the construction licenses, everything you need to do to get that project done. So I would do everything from soup to nuts, sell the project, manage it, and then you know, ultimately get them installed and stuff like that. So
that kind of gives you a perfect background into politics, right? That's,
you'd think. I mean, so you know, Matt,
because all those things, it's like, yeah, I'm starting to learn those on the fly, just kind of get into politics. But like, those are big things. So you already have that.
Yeah,
I'd
go to zoning board hearings at night and wait my turn, and then make my case, and you know, in front of a board and stuff. So, but that wasn't, I never was involved in politics. Yeah. I ended up one of the things I did when I worked for Poyant Signs was I restored the Toll House sign in Whitman. So the Toll House cookie was invented in Whitman at the Toll House restaurant.
Did we fact check this?
You can fact check it.
Yeah, we got that. Okay.
Ruth Wakefield, okay. Right. Anyway, and the Toll House itself burned down in 1984 on a New Year's Eve party. So it's crazy. The only thing that survived was the sign. And so what happened was the sign was falling into disrepair. I was able to call Nestle and get $25,000 donated from them because awesome. They have the recipe. They donated to restore the sign, so I got the sign restored. I got a local plaque in 2007, you know, thanking me for doing that. Right. And somebody says to me, "Hey, you should get involved in local politics." I was like, "I don't know."
So I'm trying to build a community. Exactly, here. Put some signs.
Just doing
up.
A little help, you know. Yeah. And my daughters were young at the time, and so the Whitman Hanson was building the brand new school that they had, and I started going to school board meetings because I wanted to see about the project, see how it was going. You know, my wife and I, her business was growing, I was doing well, and I started thinking maybe it's a chance to give back. I mean, I mentioned I was in scouting, right?
Yeah.
One of the things they teach you in scouting is leave the campground better than you found it, meaning whatever you encounter, you try to make it better. So I thought, all right, I've got a little time I can try to dedicate to giving back. So the superintendent of the school board said, "Why don't you run for school board?" I said, "I don't know. I'm not really an education guy. Let me think about it." I ended up joining the finance committee in town and becoming the liaison to the school board. So it's sort of in a roundabout way, I ended up getting involved with the school, but through the finance committee. It was on the finance committee that I learned all about our town spending. Now, this plays a point later in my history because, you know, that's when I started seeing, you know, police budgets, fire budgets, you know, everything in your town that you spend money on that nobody thinks about. You got to make sure that money's allocated, that you don't go over budget, that if there is less spending in one area, you can transfer it to other areas. So you learn about budgeting beyond your household and how a city or town does it.
And I'm actually going through that process now. So for the Braintree School Committee, I'm on the finance committee. Then obviously we have negotiations coming up. It's a $77 million budget.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's the biggest budget in town, I think it is. So it's like,
totally.
There's a lot of money that goes into it, a lot of different
Whitman
ways
Hanson,
that people playing with it.
Yeah, Whitman and Hanson, the high school is bigger than the towns at this point.
And I mean, I worked in the school since 2008, so I've been there for 15 years, and I had no idea there was this type of budget, right? You know, I mean, as an educator. So when you say, you know, I wasn't in education to get involved in it, it's like, that probably doesn't matter, right? Because the things that can help the schools are, you know, understanding that budget where...
Yeah, and you know, again, management in general is not necessarily about you being the expert on anything. It's about you putting the right person in the right place to get the job done, you know, and that's where, you know, I don't want to fast forward too much, but, you know, when I talk about being a governor, my goal is to make sure that all people who are currently working for the state realize that I'm not going to bring in consultants over the top of them to say, here's how the MBTEA should be done. Yeah. I'm going to talk to the actual workers in each you know, a state agency and say, you tell me how we need to get this done. I'm sick and tired of consultants coming in and saying, here's how things should work. And then every 4 to 8 years, you all get angry as workers that there's a new agenda coming in. You guys set the agenda because you know what your resources you need. You know how to do your job better than anybody else. There is no state rep, no governor that knows how to do everybody's job around the state. The job of the governor is to put people in place in his administration that know that are the experts.
And I think that, I mean, that's going to go a long way, because I mean, to me, the Republican Party's becoming the party of the working class, right? It's already kind of switched to there, and nobody's hearing, you know, these people that are actually getting the work done. And because of COVID, and this is every profession, right? Everyone was hit in a different way. A lot of atmospheres at work, whether it be state work, whether private, it's gotten a little toxic, right? Because, you know, COVID kind of pitted people against each other with these crazy rules and stuff. So you have these toxic environments where, you know, if you have that, you're not going to get the best out of the employee. So you want to hear what they have to say. And, you know, after you going around and doing that, because I've talked to, you know, local, you know, town workers, custodians and stuff, and like they're proud of their work. Well, they want to do a good job.
Exactly.
It's like nobody's asking
them. We shouldn't be fighting each other. Everybody just should bring their skill set forward and, like, let's celebrate what everybody does in different ways, right?
That's what I'm saying.
So, you know, when I was working for Poignant Signs, I got put on, you know, I'm one of these guys that wherever I go, I like to, you know, weigh in above and beyond, right? So I'm not just doing sales for Poignant Signs. I was doing really well. The last big project I ended up doing for them was changing the Citgo sign over Fenway from neon tubing to LED. Now, I didn't do it personally, but I got the whole project and managed it all. That. But the point is,
were you part of the Black Lives Matter sign they put up there?
No, I was not. No, I was not. But one of the things that my company Poignant did, which was really great, was we got this thing, a state grant to have Mass MEP, which comes in and teaches you the lean manufacturing system or Kaizen. You know, there's different Sigma Six. There's different ways of calling it, but basically, better management where you let the all employees have a more of a say in how their companies run. So it's not just, you know, the president, vice president of your company decides how things go. You get somebody from the manufacturing department, somebody from the accounting department. You create a team, an internal working team that says that's totally allowed to say whatever they want, good or bad. And you put on the walls all the improvements that need to happen and physically the layout of your building to make sure that, you know, your copy machine isn't, you know, placed in a place where somebody's going to walk by 10 cubicles and bother everybody on the way down, right? Yeah. You know, create more efficiencies in the way you're laying. Yeah. Exactly.
Did you do logistics at all in the Army?
Yeah. Warehouse work.
Yeah.
What we call it, warehouse work.
Running numbers. But you know what? Everybody, again, if things are done right, every worker has good ideas that need to be fed back up the chain. And that's what this MEP thing
awesome.
Did. So I learned that. That was a great system. And anyway, I'm on the finance committee, and what happens is in your local towns is right after your finance committee meetings, you know, you go over the budget and all that. You usually go across the street to Venus Pizza. This is back in the 2000s. You go to Venus Pizza and you sit around, you have a salad or a pizza, and you bitch about the budget and you bitch about the fact that the state rep wasn't bringing back the money that you needed for your towns, right? And I'm listening to all this grumbling, and I keep hearing about the state rep, and I said, well, you know, what's the problem? Well, he keeps voting with the speaker on everything, and we you know, doesn't really help our town. I said, oh, geez, okay. Well, I said, was anybody going to run against him? And nobody said they would run. So I said, well, maybe I'll run against him. So I talked to my wife, and I said, I think about running for office. And then she said, well, you know, what do you want to run for, a selectman? I said, well, kind of want to do state rep. You know, I kind of fixated that. That was the problem, so I'm going to fix it. I'm going to take care of that.
Set your sights on it.
So I called the Mass GOP, and guy named Barney Keller, John Keller's son, was working as the political director there, and he picks up the phone, and I said, what do you do to help candidates who are pro-business that want to, you know, run for office? He goes, well, I can tell you a place to get some lawn signs, but I don't really think lawn signs help anyway, so I'm not sure. I said, well, hey, this was a great productive phone call, right? So I bought two books on how to run for office, and I made crazy notes, and I figured out what it would take to run and win, and I created a, you know, game plan from Election Day backwards 2 years, and I went to the three towns I live in, went to the assessor's department. I got a map of each town with all the streets. I laminated them, mounted them to foam board, put them up on my office at home, and I took a dry erase pen, and every night I'd go out and take literature to each street, and every night I'd cross off that or highlight that street that I had just crossed off, and I just keep doing that night after night, month after month, and 2 years later, and like I said, first year, I was out there. I'm Jeff. I'm Kathy Joe Boss's husband, right? Yeah. Jeff Deal. Second year when I was out there, continuing to. Now people knew who I was. My signs are out there, and people are starting to recognize who I am, and I'm telling them what I stand for. I wanted to make sure that Beacon Hill was no longer taking advantage of us as taxpayers. You know, they weren't putting back the money to our towns that they promised us, and it was time for a change. And one of the things in 2010 that was big was they increased the sales tax from 5% to 6.25%. So working in sales, I knew that was going to be a huge hit on all these small businesses I was out there selling signs to. That hurts the economy. I mean, as much as they think that, you know, increasing taxes is great for creating state revenue, that money comes from somewhere. And in this case, the sales tax comes right out of those businesses trying to grow jobs in the state. So I was, at that point, I was fully committed to winning that state rep race.
Now, was it hard for you to kind of get that message across? Because, you know, Americans in general, and I, before I got into politics, I was the same way. We kind of look at the flashy issue of the time and stuff. When it comes to budget stuff and they're not giving the money, it's hard to kind of explain that to get people fired up. You know, hey, like, hey, I'm going to do all this budget stuff and get, you know, this money back to, wait, what?
Yeah.
No, we want you to take on the fight that they're talking about on TV, where the important part is it's in the budget, as you said. So like there, that's how they're taking advantage of it. So was it hard getting that message across?
It is, because, you know, not a lot of, you know, newspapers want to carry the story about budget items. I mean, for them,
exactly.
You know, they want the flashy sort of wedge issues that keep popping up. So I will say the one other good thing that the party, the Mass GOP, was doing in 2010 was they were consistently messaging all the way down about three major issues: the sales tax increase, the double tax on alcohol. There was already an excise tax, then they added another tax onto it. And then Sal DeMasi was Speaker of the House at the time. He was renominated to be Speaker by the current House members, and he was under investigation. Ultimately, was indicted and went away to federal prison. Well, the Mass GOP was doing a good job messaging that on a lot of radio stations, and all the candidates for state rep or state senator or whatever were talking about those issues. So we were all echoing the same policy stuff out there that basically people go, okay, I can remember three things, and those three things were pretty made people pretty angry.
So I mean, we can kind of look into that too. I mean, who got just caught recently?
Monica Cannon Grant, right?
Yeah, what happened with that?
Did she get out? They just let her out of jail.
Well, she just got indicted, right? And so now they brought her in for booking, and I think then she's got to go to trial at this
she's
point.
She's out, though. She's out.
Because they were stealing money again.
She's
right?
out. She's well, out though. Free in her house. She should be
temporarily. Let's see if justice plays out in this case. But yeah, it's a great point.
And it was kind of based off fraud again, right? They were frauding the voters in there, and as we know, there's two sets of rules, right? On the right, if we did that, everyone's on us, every cameras, newspapers, but
yeah.
You know, on the left, they kind of get to skate on some of those
things. There's no accountability.
So Monica Cannon Grant, by the way, was a big supporter of your opponent you're running for Congress against Ayanna Pressley.
Yes.
Monica Cannon Grant was a huge supporter of her. She got state grants for this Violence in Boston shelter or program that she was running.
Nonprofit.
And it turned nonprofit. And it turns out she was embezzling that money personally. So that's, you know, again, should
saying,
be a bigger
hate
story.
The play, I hate the game.
I mean, you got Attorney General, who's her friend also.
Yeah, yeah. Maura Healey was at
that's going to be your competition, right?
Most likely. Most likely. So look, the thing about it is corruption on Beacon Hill, I hate to say it, unfortunately, it tends to rear its head quite a bit, okay? The problem is, are the people aware of it, right?
Yeah.
So that when the media doesn't carry those stories, it's tough. Thankfully, when you do, you know, podcasts and you get the word out and alternately, that's important. But we have to, when you're campaigning, a lot of times you have to carry that message yourself. And so back in 2010, when I was running for state rep, you just had to go door to door. It was a shoe leather race. You have to talk to as many people as possible. By the time my opponent, who was an incumbent, who his father had been a state rep and state senator before him, realized that I was actually a threat, it was too late. We'd already set the hook, and the voters were already informed about what I stood for versus him, and I ultimately won that long shot race.
Right.
Now, that was 2010, back when Scott Brown ran for U.S. Senate and won. So the good news was Massachusetts said, you know, when Scott Brown ran, he said, I'm going to be the 41st vote against Obamacare, right?
Yeah.
Government running your health care is not going to save you money. It's not going to give you better services. Yeah. And people in Massachusetts, even though it's got a lot of Democrats, ultimately voted for Scott Brown. I feel like 22 is one of those years now where, with the pandemic and the fact that government just stepped all over us as far as our own healthcare choices, these to me are the issues of, like, 2010 had their issues.
Healthcare.
Right now, right, exactly.
It takes 2 months to get a doctor's checkup.
And I mean
you know,
obviously, Donnie was in the Army, I was in the Air Force. I mean, you look at the VA, I mean, you got to give, you know, 45 credit. He tried to start kind of revamping that, but the VA hasn't been, you know, a model group of what we want for the country.
Takes a long time to fix the stuff that's been stagnating.
And they just kind of want to throw it to it where it's like, I don't know if that's the best idea. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously the federal government runs the VAs. The state purview, the governor has more of a say on what goes on with, like, the soldiers' homes, the Holyoke and the Chelsea soldiers' homes. And those are the ones where I think we drop the ball on letting those homes be run more as medical facilities with VA sort of involvement. They actually had, I'm sorry, not VA, with veterans agents, running it. Secretary Urena was, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, and then there was somebody under him that was the head of the Soldiers' Home. Well, they were asking for more help from Mary Lou Sutters, the Health and Human Services Secretary, back when the pandemic hit, and they weren't getting help they should have had. So I think what the legislature's done now is looked at the way that it's structured and saying these need to be run more like medical care facilities with veteran agent type management of the benefits that they get, but not having them run the facility itself. Yeah. You've
kind of hit on it where, corruption, it's a part of the country. It's a part of life. You see more and more, the more and more you look, but pointing fingers, I don't think is the best way to go about it. See, they did this, they did that.
Yeah.
Where you having these ideas, hey, we know it's there, but we're changing. We're not here saying we want to get the person who did it before. We want to, run investigations, because that's what they do in D.C. all the time. We're going to have an investigation on this, and we're going to hold accountability. And 3 years later, it's like, what are we still doing? Where it's, let's get some ideas in there. It's like, hey, let's change it up. Yeah, this wasn't working. And the people that, have a problem with in the past, it wasn't working. It's not helping the people. We're changing it, all right? We're not saying you're bad people. Like, you tried, but it's something has to give.
So your point, too, is that we can look at the pandemic and say that, education in 2020 just collapsed. It fell off the table. My daughter was supposed to did graduate in 2020, had none of the proms, the graduation ceremonies, all that stuff. And it was tough, but that was just the surface. Underneath it, those last 3 or 4 months, the state wasn't prepared to do remote learning, basically. Some private schools were able to adapt immediately to Zoom and stuff. Mm-hmm. My wife's studio was able to go right to Zoom because she needs to keep, earning an income. And, she taught dance classes online. I mean, as hard as it was, everybody was in their living room dancing and all that stuff. It was crazy.
You do your best.
But public schools really weren't prepared to get that delivered. Now, in 2021, when kids were going hybrid, they were 2 days in and 3 days home. My wife and I took the studio we own, and we turned it into a learning pod during the day. And so kids would come in, and we would get them online, and they would go to their classes, and we would try to keep them online. And 6 hours a day trying to keep a kid focused on their laptop is murder.
Yeah.
But, we saw...
It's impossible.
So Zoom was a downfall for our kids,
And that's it. They weren't tuned in.
Well, yeah, so I was still teaching. So I left in the middle of 2021, and it was for all these students. So when we shut down, I knew something was up. I was like, we shouldn't be doing this. Yesterday was actually the 2-year anniversary of 15 days to slow the spread. That turned into 2 years of radically altering every part of our society.
Right.
But the kids had no say, and neither did the parents. And that was my biggest thing, because one of the biggest issues we have coming up is education and parental involvement. Because what happened was they weren't prepared. So working in Braintree, I have no ill will towards Braintree. They weren't getting the decision, but no one was prepared. And then so the parents were like, what are we supposed to do? The remote learning's not working.
Right.
But they couldn't offer him anything
else. You sort of became a homeschooler.
That's what they wanted, though. That's what they wanted. The DOE, that's what they want. They want the parents disattached from the kids. They want the kids just listening to the school, just listening to the committee.
They didn't have it.
Parents were, because I would listen to these school board meetings, and I was so against remote learning, and I was telling people we should do it, and you get grandma killer and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I was just right before they were. But I was so against it.
The science ended up proving that kids were the least at risk and all that.
And I would tell, my bosses who were great, I'd be like, this isn't working. Remote learning is a waste of time. We shouldn't be doing this. I think it's regressive. And they were like, me as just a teacher, I was like, I don't have a say in that. So they're like, well, no, just, kind of shut up and do it. I'm like, no. I can leave and just go get on the school board to make sure this doesn't happen, because the biggest problem with the public schools is the trust has been broken between the schools and the parents. And I don't blame teachers, and I don't blame parents for that. It's a lot of issues in there, but somehow we have to build those back together.
Parent participation. We need guys like Jeff, you, myself, to come in and speak about parent participation. We need more parents to be involved, want to be involved.
And transparency.
Well, so that was amazing, right? What was happening was kids had their laptops open in the kitchen, and parents were there in 2020, even in 2021, and they're seeing their kids in the curriculum that they're being taught, and they're saying, hold on, wait a minute. Some of this stuff is not appropriate for this age. Some of this stuff is questionable as far as what they're teaching my kid about their racists at an early age. What's going on here?
And so in that, some people actually even said, they were like, in the long run, was remote learning the best case scenario? Because so many parents are like, what is this?
Yeah.
Because I had started to know it. So now they call it, CRT, you know, it's SEL, the DEI. So the DEI programs, I saw it. I was still there, and I had the training, and I went off on them. But it was after George Floyd, yeah.
DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Yeah, it's or DEI, and they keep doing it. And it's basically cultural Marxism at its core. But what happened was after the George Floyd death, right, which everyone was like, yeah, hey, that shouldn't have happened. But the media just made this whole propaganda thing about it. And then they used it to put in the schools. Because if you watch in the summer of 2021, every school, like thousands of schools across the country put up DEI programs. Like, that's not organic, right? So we're all for it. I'll talk race with anyone. We have race problems and we have stuff we can talk about. We'll face those issues. But this was an agenda. There was nothing organic about it. And you're listening to it. Well, white people are inherently racist. It's like, what? Why are you teaching kids this stuff? Like, and they only focus on, you know, bad parts of history and say, hey, that's what it's all about. It's like, rather than, maybe these are kids, kind of give them the history that brought us together at that age so then they can get older to do it. Because when I was a kid, I got the Martin Luther King, you know, content of character or, you know, over color of skin, where if I didn't get that as a kid, I got older and I read Malcolm X's biography and I respected the man, right? I disagreed with him a lot, but because I had kind of had that upbringing and understanding, you know, history and all this, I could read it and being like, hey, he got dealt those hands and he fought for his people. Like, I respect that. But I don't think I could have got that if I was getting that same training like that. White people are racist and you have to hate them at a young age. I'd be like, well, no, we're against each other. And it's almost pitting people against each other.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely questionable, especially when you're talking about kids who are, I think, growing up right now in a very tolerant, you know, environment. We've had a black president. We've had, you know, they looking around going, where's the inequity that I'm enjoying right now? Yeah, the white privilege that I'm supposedly.
Millennials, for us, I feel like the best thing that millennials has had is, you know, race relations on like the everyday level, whether it be at work, whether you go to a bar, whether you go to like a club or, you know, go to a game. We're mixing. Like, it was the best it's probably been in this country. And then 5-6 years ago, something started kind of being put in where, all right, now we're kind of back at it. And again,
Obama was put in.
He did that. And they're the first ones that brought Common Core.
I'm from Roxbury. South Boston is right over the bridge. You guys been to my spot, my dive, my Wednesday's eye bar. That's the place. If people walk in there, probably won't come out, you know? This is how it is. It's like one of those old school bars from Southie. So I grew up in Southie. I lived in
Today, St. Patty's Day. They'll be staying there for a few days.
Right. So they say Southie is racist. Massachusetts, that article that came out, Massachusetts is the most racist state in America, which is absurd because I think I grew up, all my best friends were in Southie. You know some of my best friends. It was no skin color with us in Southie, which is, they say Southie's really racist. It's not. Well, my buddies in Southie, there's no skin color. Are you African American? I said, I'm straight up, dude, I'm American. I'm not, nobody in my family's from Africa, bro. Nobody. I'm American. But you're black. Listen, if you wouldn't even know where my family come from, they come from Honduras. All right, so I have none of them people from Honduras know anything about Africa. Yeah. Anything. Like, I'm not African. Nobody in my family can tell you about Africa.
And
I'm
can
American.
See that.
That's it.
The Obama pushed that. And, I mean, it goes back in this era, especially in Braintree, where, I mean, you're a little older, Jeff, you might know, where my parents kind of started, we're busing, right? Everyone knows about busing in, you know, in Boston, where it's like, oh, everyone, the white people were all racist. Where if you go back to it, I mean, it's almost revisionist history. It was, you know, that elitist, what, Judge Garrity up in Wellesley, who signed it off from his millionaire house. He sent poor kids to South from Southie to war with poor kids from Roxbury, right?
Yeah, no one was shown. They weren't shown the white kids getting off the bus in Dorchester getting rocks thrown at them.
Yeah.
They just showed, weren't showing that.
And it worked both ways, so it's like everyone that's in there where it's like it wasn't about schools where if you guys obviously know Clarence Thomas. I mean, he's the man. If you guys have ever seen his documentary, it's great. He was a part of that, right?
Biden credit.
Yeah, so he was
man.
In that, and he talks about being here in Boston where it was because of those riots he actually saw was going on. He went to a church and got down and prayed and was like, you know, I'll walk away from this stuff. Because he was like, he just thought, I never would want my kids to go through this, that put in a situation like that. And that's what politics could do because it was a political thing. Like, of course there was race problems back then. Everyone knew it. Like, everyone's met racists before in our lives. Mm-hmm. But they were using the schools to pit against each other where it's like, are they doing it again now? And that's the part that scares me because it's already happened in our history just locally.
So, I mean, again, you have to kind of create that environment where you say that there's racism involved so that you can try to identify people who are trying to do things. For example, like have a secure border and make sure that immigration is done correctly, you can point to that and say, see, you're racist. We have racism here and you're racist. It's not racism. It's following the law. I don't care what country you come from, for, whether it's Sweden or whether it's Mexico or Honduras. Yeah. I don't care where you come from. Just come here legally and that's all we're asking.
And that kind of brings me to our next point. Legally, yeah, so if you want to, like, I mean, your parents were immigrants.
Yeah, from Honduras, which was, they're taking all the people from Honduras now. And my parents and my family are upset. They're bothered about, you know, how many illegal Hondurans are letting in, because they're like, wow, we had to wait 10, 15 years, pay 10 grand a piece, study for years to take a test about some history we don't know about, and make sure, like, you know, we learn that history. And
by the way, I just got to tell you, so when I was in the legislature, I filed a bill to try to speed up immigration, because 100 years ago, it used to be you could come to your district court if you knew the language, had a sponsor, had a job, you had a certain 5 years to become a citizen, and they would swear you in. Now it's become taken over by the Department of Immigration and Refugees, and it's broken. It's kept broken. It's expensive. It takes a long time. What we should do is make it go back to that old thing. You earn your way in, and once you're in, you're in. And guess what? Those immigrants that I hate to say it, the Democratic Party right now is the one where they want the illegals to have the ability to come here, to get licenses, all that. Like, I want people to come here, just do it legally. But here's the thing. Those people who come here illegally end up working under the table. They pay taxes. You know, the Democrats will say, well, they pay taxes out of their paycheck. They do. But the problem is they will never have that Social Security on the back end to help them retire someday. They are going to basically be abused. They'll work twice the hours, half the rate sometimes, and they don't get all the protections, and they certainly don't get that retirement money in the Social Security, you know, that would help them, you know, again, when they're ready to retire. Right. So it's abusing that whole population.
Yeah, ultimately. So I love the ideas you have here. That's why I'm, you know, such a big fan of yours is, you know, you've already sponsored bills on how to do it. But it's a two-step problem. Like, we in Massachusetts think what's going on.
And by the way, it's not just Democrats. I should say this to Matt. It's chambers of commerce around this country who represent entertainment industries like hotels and restaurants that love having people here that will work at low rates for long hours, and they can kind of, you know, push around. And those chambers of commerce tend to be, you know, I will say lean, maybe funded more by Republicans or supported Republicans in the past. We've got to take those big corporations that have woven themselves into government. They're the ones that create the extra regulation, so the small businesses get forced out because the small businesses can't keep up with the red tape or the regulation costs. The bigger ones, you know, you see the strip malls with all the brand names from around the country, you know, the same plazas across the entire country. Mm-hmm. Those are the big ones that can afford to pay the fines or pay the regulations and stuff. And your mom and pop, whatever the business is, are getting forced out. It's the small businesses that create the innovation and job growth in our country. They're the ones that create those long-term, they apprentice some kid into that business, and then that kid takes over the business, or they launch those careers. Like the sports leaders you were talking about earlier, the fathers and the women who take kids and help develop them. Those small businesses also develop kids into becoming entrepreneurs of their own, or at least knowing a work ethic that they can take out into the workforce. So, you know, we've got to get back to, you know, Newt Gingrich used to say this when he was in Congress, and he did the whole contract with America, and he said, I want government to be a giant centrifuge of power, meaning, you know, it tends to funnel up money, and power funnels up through your state, your local level into the state level, and state up into the federal government. Newt wanted to push it all back like a centrifuge, push that power back down out into the states and back out into the local communities. Decentralized, because the best decisions that get made are local. You know, how is somebody in Missouri going to know what a good fishing issue is in Massachusetts? They don't, but the federal government regulates fishing in Massachusetts in a way that doesn't make sense. They stick a monitor on our boats. Our fishermen have to pay for somebody, an intern from some part of the country, to come and stand on their deck and watch what fishing is being brought onto the boats. They get in the way of the fishermen trying to do their job. They have no idea what they're identifying, and they end up screwing everything up, you know, and they have to pay for it.
Yeah, that ties in right to what we were, I mean, we were just outside at the Braintree Instruction, the John Adams there.
Yeah.
Right, self-government. That was that local aspect there where you make your local decisions.
Should not decide what, you know, force attacks on a population that had no representation back. In fact, the original taxation.
And neither should King Biden.
Yeah.
You know how that point you said how Newt wanted to take the money
Money, but power. I mean, decision making, everything, centrifuge it right back out.
Well, one of the things that we were talking about this past summer, which is a big hit now, and I'm going against sanctions, is having every child graduate with a Volk trade skill in our district in Massachusetts. Why? Because that's going to help us trade with each other, barter. That's going to boom our economy.
I love it. You know,
that's how we boom our economy. That's build back better.
But the hard part is
get a skill.
How can you do that as governor? Because, I mean, let's be realistic. And even, again, I have no problem with liberals, even progressives. Like, I don't have a problem with the American people. Ideologies and certain institutions. But the left does have a monopoly on education, and especially higher ed, where the Overton window has gone so far left. Like, how do we pull that back from a political standpoint?
You know, I think what we're realizing now is that a four-year college degree isn't worth what it used to be worth, because a lot of kids now have to go on to get a master's degree.
They all work at Shaw's now. They're working at Shaw's, Stop and Shop. Yeah.
So if you're able to look at a vocational school and say, look, I want to work with my hands, electrical work, even it doesn't even have to be necessarily that. You could computer-aided drafting, CAD drawing, right? You can learn that at Wentworth. I know a guy who will help you go get an evening course. If you work for this company that's down in East Bridgewater, work for him. After 3 years, he'll put you through Wentworth in night school and stuff to learn CAD drawing, because he needs that for stuff. You can get your education in a way that applies directly to the work you're doing. So to me, people who are now looking at either apprenticeships or working in a vocation right after high school, that's great. In fact, these vocational high schools have a waiting list to get in. It used to be in the 70s, it was a stigma. Mm-hmm. Now you can't even get into them.
That's why you got to put
most of the folks, you know,
schools.
You got
to
say,
that's
these
what
kids,
we want every public school
kids has. Graduating with a law degree, you're lucky if you're making back your money in the first 10 years. Kids who graduate from a vocational school are probably earning $100,000-$150,000 within 2-3 years.
Buying a house in full.
Putting
two guys to work, having to buy a truck, putting two guys to work.
And have a skill that will take them for the rest of their life.
Like all of us, if we went off to college at 18, it was my friends that went to the trades that are the ones that have money now and have all the big houses.
Giving me some of jobs, giving me some of work.
But we have that, but I mean, for that, even college was so expensive. I don't know, have you heard of like the dual enrollment programs that happen through schools? So when I was there, we used to do this dual enrollment program through Massasoit. And we get cheap classes, you know, we'd fund money, we'd raise some money. So these kids would get cheap classes, and they would take a class in high school, right? So they would have an online class, we'd teach it in the school, and they'd get college credit for it. So it worked out great for, you know, some kids could leave high school with 12, 15 credits. But it also, you know, kids could take these classes and see, like, you know, maybe college isn't for me. This is what it would look like. So at least gave them an exposure.
The other thing I like too is that Massachusetts community colleges allow you to do 2 years there.
Yeah.
And then if you think college is for you and you want to maybe take it up a level, you can transfer those community college credits to go to a state school like UMass Amherst or something. Yeah. So it's nice. They give you that flexibility to see.
I mean, we're known
if it's going to work
schools.
For you.
Like,
totally.
Again, I have problems with Ivy League. In the sense of some of the people they produce, but not the schools itself, right? They're still foundations.
Well, and this is the problem too, is that the state set up state school systems to be, you know, an alternative to the private schools that were very expensive. And now the state schools seem to be competing with the Ivies as far as the salaries they're giving teachers and stuff. You're like, holy cow. I mean, this, you know, super unaffordable. It's very expensive. I mean, you know, right now there's the whole tuition and fees. So yeah, state tuitions are low, but the fees have grown to the point where it's very expensive to go to a state college. And they were supposed to be the alternative, right?
Yeah, it's like it's a basic training now in schools now. Like, you can't go out; you have to get tested every 2 days and stuff.
Yeah,
who needs that? You're almost better off getting a job.
So yeah, I mean, I don't know how we solve the indoctrination that seems to be happening on campuses, but you know, I hopefully just talking about. Conservative values.
Yeah, so that kind of leads into the next kind of question we want to see is, you know, the building block of this country is the family, right? That's where, you know, people always talk white privilege. I don't have white privilege. I have privilege. It came from my family, right? My parents gave me, you know, they wanted to build a better life for me, so I got that type of stuff. It's hard now, right? You can't have a one-income family right now and raise kids like you could, like my parents could do. You know what I mean? My mother waitressed on the side, but, like, they still got away with it. We can't afford that anymore. And where, how do you beat that system? It's family values, right? Those conservative family values that you get in the home from, you know, parents and from community.
You know,
but how can you do that anymore?
The other problem too is that if the kids are, first of all, you got to have them sit down and have dinner with you. Right? That's one thing.
That's true.
The next thing is if they're at dinner, these kids are sitting there bang 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 on the phone and they're distracted. And
well, you have kids.
Two daughters. They learn a lot of their social cues now from the groupthink that's happening over the internet right now. So it's hard. Parents are competing with, first of all, right? Like you said, both are at work. So now schools have the first crack at kind of changing some of what they're learning as far as. You know, the overall mentality. Secondly, you know, the internet stuff is affecting them. And third, you know, your communities, you know, a lot of times you live in a community that starts to go, I hate to say woke, yeah, right? I mean, oh, all
yeah,
of a sudden,
you got the woke, yeah.
It's more like political correctness takes over instead of, in the old days, we used to have block parties and parents, the neighbors
exactly.
could, if I acted up, my mom would let the neighbors come and say, you know, give me a smack on the rear end
yeah,
and say, you don't ever talk to somebody like that, right?
Yeah.
Nowadays, you know, that woke attitude is like, you know, don't you ever touch my kid. Exactly.
And I feel like that's a problem where we have to kind of get back to it. And the biggest thing to me is social media. So kind of being in the Air Force, you know, working in intelligence, it's the biggest human intelligence network ever created. So to me, I've always kind of viewed it as a weapon. Now, those have to kind of be harnessed. Like, I can use it to find information in a way so most people can't. But people can always use that against kids.
Well, okay. So here's a perfect example, Matt. So peers, like, they're these kids in school, they do their streaks, right, with the kids and keep up and all that stuff. But they're also, but there's the influencers. I mean, people are literally social influencers, right? And the White House just brought in TikTok social influencers to try to sell the American people on the Ukrainian situation.
The Ukraine-Russia situation.
Yeah, I mean, what the hell?
And that's a problem. So to me, you know, I mean, this is obviously a ground thing idea, and I think it would have to be parents-based. But don't you think we should view kind of social media like we view as getting a license or the drinking age, right?
Even public television, you weren't allowed to swear or certain content wasn't allowed. I mean, maybe, you know, and again, I'm also a free market guy and I don't believe government should overstep.
Exactly.
But at some point, you know, some of this content is questionable.
But you think it should be right?
And by the way, if the other ironic part is organic content, like when we're talking about the pandemic and putting our own views about COVID out there, Facebook and Twitter tag it as a, you know, sensitive material. You're like, whoa, hold on. I'm just trying to
the original Facebook. They threw it off. Yeah. So they censor it. But to me, it would almost be like the way I look at it is as a license. Like, hey, take a class before you can kind of get your independent social media skills, right? To have it on your own, where have your parents pay, have an age group on it, be like, hey, you know, 16, you can use it. Because
so that's a great point.
We should look at it. It is dangerous
for
some kids.
One of the things that we talk about, like needing civics in schools.
Yeah, you mentioned that earlier, and I couldn't agree more.
Because, you know, a lot of times they aren't learning the true full history on both sides of everything. The other thing, too, is financial literacy. A lot of these kids aren't even aware of how to balance a checkbook when they come out of high school. They don't know how to use anything, right?
Yeah.
Well, maybe social media is becoming one of those things that it's predatory in some ways, like lending. Yeah. Maybe there needs to be some sort of classes to explain kids what may or may not be, you know, appropriate material to share. Look, I mean, a lot of kids put stuff online that they're going to come to regret, you know, 10, 20 years from now.
If I was in high school and I had social media, it would be terrible. You know what I mean?
Know,
like,
yeah, right.
They're kids. They're under the microscope all the time. Like, we have, like, parents that will come and be like, well, this kid wrote this. It's like, yeah, that's awful what he did, but he's still a kid, right? We still have to keep that in mind. We're kind of taking their childhood away where it is – and I like what you said, because you don't want that government overreach. We've talked about how there's been so much, and it doesn't come from you, but
maybe
that
more,
should be a parent-driven thing. Like, what do parents think about it? What do you see as
– parents, or then maybe a class where at least there's a discussion about it or something like that. You know, a back-and-forth discussion, so it's not just being told this is what you can or can't do.
Yeah, and I'm 100%, you know, down for what you say. I mean – You see the battlefield clearly, right? And that's a big part about it, because all Americans are asking for is our freedom back. I know, like, the worst thing I hate is when people trivialize the word freedom. Like, oh, freedom, we need freedom. It's like, hey, a lot of people died for that, for us to have this way of life. It doesn't come. It doesn't just come naturally.
Ask
right
the Ukrainians
here.
Right now.
Exactly.
What
right?
freedom means to
and
them.
And you see around the world, like, we have it so good here, but we're letting it go. And, you know, people
so
with the most
to that.
The people with the most to lose are kind of giving it away. So, you know, we'll finish up here. You know,
yeah,
Jeff,
we've been going
I really
on a
do
pretty good
chair
here.
There's one question I do want to ask, though. Like, how was it to get, you know, 45 President Trump's endorsement? That must have been pretty
That
good.
Was exciting. I mean, to be honest with you.
I saw it, I was like, let's go.
If you told me a week earlier that was going to happen, I would have never guessed it. I kind of learned very quickly that he was interested in the race. The next thing I know, he's calling me talking about the race. And then the next thing I know, I've got his endorsement,
awesome.
Right? So it was good. I mean, and I, you know, supported him in 16. I saw what he was talking about, which was making American, you know, putting America first in a lot of ways, whether it's jobs and the economy, whether it's energy independence, whether it's pulling troops back from, you know, endless wars, you know, where our national interest necessarily isn't being represented, whether it was, again, tightening immigration and making sure people come here the right way. Everything he was saying made a lot of sense. And yet, for some reason, he was villainized in a way that I've never seen in my entire life. And, you know, I think that 4 years we had with him as president gave us record unemployment, gave us prosperity that we've probably unrivaled. And it's all being turned completely on its head. We, you know, the stock market's crashing. Yeah. The energy, you know, oil crisis right now is we should be producing our own oil. We're not. It's strange to see Washington, D.C. and the Biden administration do everything they can to tank what was done over the last 4 years. It almost feels like it's in spite of him, but truthfully, it feels like it's a bigger thing. Like there's an effort to try to undercut the prosperity of America right now, and we need to make sure, not just in the country federally, but right here in Massachusetts, it was red states that stayed open and helped keep our economy going. You know, we need Republican governors in these states to make sure that even if it's a Democratic legislature, we do the right thing as far as letting individual businesses stay open and let those individuals enjoy the freedom they have to stay in the state, be able to make a living, afford to stay. We had 50,000 people leave Massachusetts last year. 50,000. We've got to make sure Massachusetts, you can live here, not leave here. Okay, that's going to be important.
So, and you understand, though, if you lose, like that's going to double.
Yeah, a lot of those. You got some big shoes to fill.
We're not going to lose. We can't lose. We cannot.
A lot of those people that were 50,000 were business owners too.
Yeah. Oh, those 50,000 people.
Swarms.
I agree. So, I mean, we need you here, and I love the confidence you exude. You know, I've got to know you, get to know you over the past couple months, and you know, I really think you're on to something here. You're building with the grassroots. You have the small business aspect. And again, you were a union guy at some point, so you see the side of it.
It's
where
for the people, Jeff.
These are it's an issue.
My kids drive this whole thing. Look, I got to tell you, at this point, I'm 52. I've had a great chance to experience, you know, all the great stuff this country can offer. We've built a business. I've been able to serve in government. It's been an honor. Tremendous things I've been able to do. Live in Massachusetts, great thing. I want this for my daughters and then some. I want them to have a better future than I've had. And, you know, this is one of those generations where we're not sure that the future generations are going to have those better futures. I want to make sure that we deliver for what was given to me, that great prospect for the future. So whether it's your daughter or your kids or my kids, I want to make sure that they stay here. My grandkids, I get to bounce them on the knee, you know, right here in Massachusetts. That's the goal. That's the goal.
Amen to that. I think that's that common value.
That's it.
Of family where family. We all have that building family. Block.
And by the way, you know, again, one last thing about being in, you know, school and as an educator yourself, the kids who are raised with grandparents involved in their lives end up doing better. And you know what? That's what the intangible. If my grandparents or if my parents have to leave, my wife's parents have to leave Massachusetts to go to a more affordable state, my grandkids are going to lose out. And if my kids leave the state, I'll lose out. I mean, we're all going to lose out if we get split up because this state becomes unaffordable. We've got to keep it affordable and a place where people feel like their input, their lives matter, you know, equally with everybody else. And what's happening right now is it feels like it's not just Democrat, Republican, it's government. Those people make, you know, they escape, you know, no laws apply to them. They make the rules, and we all have to live by those rules, right? The politicians that were told us we had to wear masks, but they weren't wearing masks. That's the craziness that's going on.
Hypocrisy.
We got to all live equally in this state, in this country.
Amen to that. So, how can people find you on social media, and where can we donate? We need to get you.
Yeah.
So where can we find you on there?
Yeah, it's only $1,000 donation limit, so that's great, right? it's jeffdiehl.com, jeffdiehl.com. So my mom, for some reason, thought, you know, my last name wasn't already a challenge.
I know.
She said, let's make Jeff a challenge too. So Jeff is with a G, jeffdiehl. I must have been a tough childbirth. I don't know what happened. She got angry at me. But
we can throw that up in the link, so I hope everybody kind of donates to Jeff.
But you know what?
We
don't just donate. The other thing, too, is there's a place where you can volunteer. You can be a poll watcher to make sure that we have secure elections. You can volunteer to do campaign activities, holding signs, all that stuff. If you're out there working with other people to help me get elected, you're meeting other like-minded folks, and you can help maybe recruit one of them to run for legislative office someday. So, you know, your involvement in this campaign doesn't just mean translate into victory in November. It translates into a long-term a process of getting more and more people involved and educated on what the issues actually are. So get involved, because if you don't get involved, you don't have any right to complain. And I don't mean to say that, you know, too rudely, but really,
we're good.
If you're complaining and you're not being part of the solution, what the heck are you doing? What are you doing? So that's it. Let's get involved.
We're with you on that. So, thank you for coming. Next governor of Massachusetts, Jeff Deal. We need him to win here.
With the next congressman.
The next congressman, Donnie Palmer. We're going to be hearing a lot from Donnie, though. This podcast is going to start taking off.
I think Matt's got a big future ahead.
So we really do appreciate coming by. Anything we can do here at, the Mass Generals podcast, we'll get the message out. It's hard to kind of deal with media, so if you ever need to come back, you ever want to get a message out and get something across, we can do. But
this is the model. Tell it like it is. This is the model.
We're fully behind you, and we have an army behind us, and me and Donnie are building because we're the vets here.
We're generals.
So we're taking this. That's it. So anything we can do for Jeff, we really do appreciate coming by today, taking the time out of your day, and keep fighting. We're with you.
Thank you, fellas.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.